Hello, and welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast. In the latest influenza surveillance reports from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which observed a steady rise in cases early in the year, the message issued by the CDC has remained the same. The flu season is just beginning, and it's not too late to receive a flu vaccination. In keeping with that suggestion, today's episode of Doc Talk will focus on flu vaccines. Managing editor Kevin Kunzman sat down with Dr. Kipe Talbot to speak of innovations in the realm of flu vaccines and how new developments in the management of shingles and COVID-19 could inform future iterations of the flu vaccine. Major developments in flu vaccines are made during the avian influenza outbreak that occurred in the early 2000s. Since then, several new types of flu vaccines have been under development, with some making their way to the market. However, as different strains of influenza continue to emerge, researchers are on an ever-evolving quest to meet these new forms of the virus with safe and effective vaccines. Let's hear more about how they go about developing these vaccines from Dr. Talbot.
Dr. Talbot, as I was saying, just really appreciate your time. Obviously, unfortunately, influenza right now is a highly pertinent subject in the country as we're having some continued discussion around risk of co-infection with raging COVID-19 cases, as well as just mitigating flu risks overall in the middle of the flu season. It is early January, so it seems as good a time as any to discuss some preventive and mitigative measures that we could be putting into place right now to at least reduce the risk of one respiratory virus while we're losing a fight against another. So I wanted to start with you and ask if you can give us some background into where's the current state of flu vaccine research going right now? What are our available products and where do you see it going?
There's been a lot of interest in flu since about 2004. There's always been interest in flu, but I think we really got interested when we started looking at avian flus. And that might even have been back as far as 2000. And new types of flu vaccine have been under development since then. And some of them have come to market. We now have a high-dose flu vaccine for those over 65. We have what's called an adjuvanted flu vaccine. It means it gives the immune system a little kick to get it really responding well for adults over 65. And we also have another vaccine that's high-dose, but not as high as the high-dose, that also helps give a better immune response. But almost all of those are based on older technology. And so we're really looking forward to moving that needle forward and getting some new technology, figuring out what's the best way to teach your body how to fight flu. I think those are the big things. I think the other thing that we forget about too with flu is the people who get the most sick with influenza are people whose immune systems are hard to teach. Right. That's what I mean by that. Those that are immunocompromised, those that are older. And so we really need to learn how to make vaccines to teach those immune systems that are having trouble learning so they can really learn how to fight that flu that comes.
That's really fascinating. And obviously, I think so much of the discussion that we've had around this entire development of the COVID-19 vaccines that are now available in widespread use, you know, early into discussions when speaking to vaccinologists asking for a hopeful window of vaccine efficacy, the VE data point that we're all always looking at, there's a lot of estimation and hope around 60 to 70% because of just the broad range of efficacy that we can see for vaccines. With flu, it's always such a moving target and it's so difficult. And I'm glad you mentioned the difficulties that we face in immunizing, you know, some of our most at-risk groups. Do you see a potential in development of available therapies and implementation of technology to really improve, I guess, that standard for vaccine efficacy for flu?
I do think there's hope. We're finally beginning to look at vaccines for older adults, the aging immune system, mm-hmm. the one that's having trouble learning. And there have been a few home runs in that area. So the new shingles vaccine, right. Has an adjuvant in it and creates an incredibly effective immune response in older ages. And so I think those types of advances are going to come forward and be used for other vaccines. And so I think there's hope. I think we are all impatient because We all want it now. If you want to watch a movie, you can turn on Netflix and you got it and you don't wait. But this is going to take some time because when we do these studies, we want to make sure that they're safe. The benefit always has to be greater than the risk. And so we're going to go through all those steps. We did all the same steps for COVID, but we squeezed them in really tight and overlapped them and did some of them in parallel. But we usually don't do that. So it's going to take a little bit longer for vaccines like the flu vaccine.
And what about the implementation or possible potential use of mRNA technology in influenza? Is there potential there for vaccine?
Oh, absolutely. I think the hard thing for flu is it changes all the time. Yeah. It's always changing. It's never dull studying influenza because it's never the same. And the other factor is there are three main types that circulate in humans. So there are not only three types, but all three types can change. And sometimes they change a little bit and sometimes they change drastically. Yeah. And so it's always kind of a race for us to figure out what might circulate. And then will that grow in the technology that we currently have and then move forward? Messenger RNA gives us a little bit more time so we don't have to grow it in eggs, which is fabulous. But we still have to make a really good educated guess. And so that's the kicker with flu. Sometimes we get it right on and it is awesome. Yeah. And sometimes it just tells different.
Other times it's 2009, 2010, when it's sort of out of our grasp. And yeah, it was that.
Even sometimes even a subtle change can make a difference. So a few years ago, the virus said, you make an immune response to this one part. And so it added a sugar. It literally added a sugar to that part of the virus. Right. So that when we made antibodies, it didn't make a difference.
Right.
And so it very effectively changes, even if there are small changes sometimes.
It's a strong resiliency. And I'm glad we're talking about it too, because another pertinent discussion right now during the Omicron variant spread is the hope that this is an indication of us eventually reaching endemic status with the virus. It's weakening. It's still more transmissible than ever, but it's weakening. We're less burdened and affected and concerned with the severity of disease that's coming from this. There's been a lot of expectation from experts, of course, that this is what we're eventually working to. Can we imagine that? I of course, I don't want to be making, you know, direct parallels between flu, not even the flu pandemic of the last century to the COVID-19 pandemic. But is there certain blueprints that exist from what we've seen from the mutations and evolutions of influenza as to what we could be likely dealing with COVID-19 in the future?
Yeah, we don't know as much as we would like because many of those evolutions in flu happened before we even could sequence. And so this is a whole new ballgame. And actually, some of us who study flu are really excited about these changes going on with COVID because we may be able to go back and look at flu and study flu this way.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. Okay. So I think we're going to learn both fields. We're going to go back and forth between what we know. So yeah, I don't think we know. So there are two things with that virus. One is none of us are immune. So wide open has a total population that's susceptible. And then two, it really is a pathogenic virus. Even if we provide some immunity, it still can be rather pathogenic, which means what's a good regular word for that? Really aggressive. And disease causing. So I think that's the thing. So I think there are two steps. One is until the whole population has immunity, it really doesn't matter how aggressive that virus is or not. Because if you have no immunity, you are still at risk for severe disease. Mm-hmm. So when half of our population is not vaccinated for COVID, they're still at risk for having severe disease, even if it's a wimpier virus. Right. And so I think that's something that gets lost in the messaging.
Absolutely. And something that we discussed with an expert in public health this week leading up to our coverage of flu was pertaining the fact that we may see, you know, changes in vaccine efficacy as well as we're continuing to fight this, where it's reduced and reduced and reduced. And again, drawing that connection to influenza. But I'm glad you mentioned it from the other end as well, like what COVID-19 could be informing on ongoing, you know, attempts to mitigate the effect of other respiratory viruses. I know even RSV, we're making a lot of progression, right, and vaccine opportunities as well. So it seems like this whole field is starting to better inform itself, right?
And we've always wondered, you know, if people wore masks and stayed home and washed their hands, could we stop viruses? We saw almost no flu and RSV when we went into lockdown. Like it went away. Like we saw none of it. I've been doing flu research for 20 years and all of a sudden there was no flu, which is kind of exciting. I mean, think about it. So I think not that I want to be in lockdown forever, but I do think we did learn, you know, maybe if you stayed home when you're sick and don't spread it, we might not have these big outbreaks. Maybe kids will be better in school, stay better in school. All those alcohol hand gels are everywhere that now people automatically use. Maybe they really should be in schools, you know, maybe really cut down some of the spread. So I think even some of the non-medicine, non-vaccine stuff that we've seen be very effective, we can carry over, not to lockdown extent, but we can wash our hands more.
Of course. That's great to hear. Thank you for that, Dr. Talbot. And speaking specifically on, you mentioned sequencing, obviously, our preparation strategies that go into influenza. I'm curious to ask you if anything from COVID-19 has sort of informed new methodology or ways of thinking for flu, because obviously, as you're saying, it's so difficult, like gauging the Southern Hemisphere, trying to get a good read on what's going to be circulating in a few months. That's really tough to be hitting that moving target.
And there's some years where we have to guess next year and we haven't had flu yet. So it can be, thankfully, very smart people do this. So I think the one thing that we were missing in flu was infrastructure.
Yes.
To be able to sequence thousands of viruses in a very short manner of time, we have not had. And so we still don't quite have that yet with COVID, but we have much more than we did 3 years ago. And so I'm hoping this continues to push the field and continues to provide this as almost a service that happens regularly in flu so that we get data in real time versus a year later.
And how much of that, obviously the sequencing has been, you know, fantastic in the places that we've been able to set it up, but I have heard from other experts on that level too, that there needs to be more, and even more importantly, we need to better bridge our networks of sequencing, right? I mean, as a 50 state nation, it's really difficult for us to navigate all these, you know, across different institutions, right? Is there any discussion about what that could look like, particularly for flu manifesting or suggestion? Do we already have that blueprint or is it something we're still?
No, I don't think so. I think most of your public health and academic people and physicians and other clinicians have been in survival mode for 2 years. And so we haven't had that chance to say, okay, how can we now take this and make it really phenomenal? And I'm hoping we do get that chance to do that. I hope things slow down. Omicron has said not yet. But I do think there'll become a time when we will get to build those infrastructure. And it's not just sequencing, because you can find a change in the virus, but it may not mean anything. So unless you have the clinical data to go with it and the epidemiological data. So unless I know how sick they get and how many people get sick, the variant data is not worthwhile. You need all three together.
Thanks again to Dr. Talbot for being part of the program. And thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Doc Talk next week. Until then, keep up to date on the latest flu news and more by following us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. Stay safe, stay healthy, and tune in next week for more Doc Talk.